6. The Coalition. September 2012 through July 2013. When Special Agent Ray Donovan arrived for his first day of work at the DEA's Special Operations Division, walking into a drab government building in an office park in Chantilly, Virginia, he found the men and women who would soon become his partners in chasing Chapo Guzman still chewing over the FBI's huge missed opportunity in Cabo San Lucas. It was early 2012, a little more than 6 months after the kingpin slipped away. As Donovan discovered, SOD's assessment of Operation Server Jack was that it was a shit show. Methodically, he heard his colleagues say, the mission had been brilliant, pure technical genius. But from a management perspective, shit show. For months, the water cooler grousers said, the Bureau's case agents, acting more like spies than cops, had simply listened as the world's most famous drug lord went about his business. Even after the DEA had launched its own raids in Cabo, the FBI, they felt, had been disinclined to share intelligence. If the raids had been a shit show too, the general consensus at SOD was still that the Bureau could have and should have acted sooner. They weren't nullifying the target. They were sitting on his phone, said Donovan's new supervisor in the unit's Mexican section. It was frustrating to think there was a branch of government that was up on Guzman for more than a year. If we'd had their information at the time, we could have taken him off the streets. In his new position as a staff coordinator, Donovan's job at SOD was to bring federal agencies together, not divide them further. While he, too, may have looked askance at Server Jack's go-it-alone administrative style, he preferred, as the unit's new guy, to focus on the future. Founded in 1992, SOD was created to serve as that rarest of governmental entities, a centralized hub of information. Under the motto, One Team, One Fight, its investigators not only funded and supported operations in dozens of DEA offices around the world, they also tried to build bridges to other U.S. law enforcement outfits and to the intelligence community. Within a week of arriving at the division's headquarters on the outskirts of Dulles Airport, Donovan went to see the unit's leader, Derek Maltz, with an ambitious game plan squarely in keeping with its interagency mandate. I want to be a part of something that's going after Chapo, Donovan said. I love your attitude, kid, Maltz answered with a laugh. But Donovan was serious. We'll put something together, he promised, not by accident in the first person plural. We'll figure out how to get him. That first week, Donovan dove in to the biggest homework assignment of his career, poring over everything that SOD had gathered on Guzman and the Sinaloa drug cartel. Sitting at his desk for hours at a stretch, he turned the pages of investigative and intelligence reports, absorbing the kingpin's expansive history and the seemingly unending attempts to capture him over the years. Born in the Bronx to a single mother who raised 5 children and worked 3 jobs, Donovan approached this task hardwired with an almost manic sense of tenacity. When he first joined the DEA in 1998 as a member of a task force in New York, a team of federal agents, city detectives, and local state troopers, he quickly earned a reputation as a first-in, last-out kind of guy. In one of his early cases, Donovan developed an informant in the Bronx who tipped him off that a warehouse in the Hunts Point food market was being used to stash cocaine. Setting up surveillance, he watched the building on a live feed from his office every day for 9 months straight, sometimes until 2 in the morning. At just the point where most of his task force buddies thought he was insane, a tractor-trailer turned down Hunts Point Avenue and backed into the warehouse's cargo bay. The bus that resulted was relatively small, a little more than 300 kilos, but where other agents might have made the collar and taken the statistics, Donovan and his colleagues traced the truck back to its origins, squeezing sources and tracking leads through Mexico to Colombia, then all the way to Panama. 2 years later, their labors paid off with a bigger bust, this time at a Panamanian merchant freighter linked to Guzman's ally-turned-enemy, Arturo Beltran Leyva. The ship was carrying nearly 20,000 kilos of cocaine, or almost 20 tons. It was, at the time, the largest drug seizure in DEA history. One of Donovan's specialties was digging into the communication networks of vast drug mafias and leveraging wiretaps to piece together detailed maps of who was who within the organizations. It was a skill that served him well, as he spent months acclimating himself to the disorienting world of live investigations into Guzman. By late 2012, there were dozens of active cases in New York, Chicago, Miami, El Paso, and as far away as Spain and China that touched at least in part on the kingpin and his empire. Many of these efforts, Donovan determined, could trace their roots to a landmark wire investigation that had started in Los Angeles that spring. Coming up for air one night, Donovan realized something. The DEA already had everything it needed to go after Chapo Guzman, but the tips and tools were scattered in the files of scores of different agents strewn across the country. A vast amount of investigative energy had been lavished on the kingpin in the past 3 years, and yet there was no single effort or overarching strategy to track him down and capture him. It was, Donovan felt, the usual governmental siloing. Separate offices in separate cities were all laying hands, like blind men, on different parts of the giant Guzman elephant. But what if, and he knew it was a big if, they could come together and hunt the elephant as a team? Looking for a way to build that team, Donovan immersed himself in the mother case from Los Angeles, Operation Crackberry. Like many breakthrough investigations, Crackberry started with an innocuous event. In May 2012, just before Donovan arrived at SOD, a Mexican money courier was picked up during a traffic stop in Beverly Hills. Under questioning, the courier admitted that the $500,000 in cash discovered in his car belonged to the Sinaloa drug cartel. He also coughed up a fascinating tip, his own connection to the organization. Heriberto Zazueta Godoy had been keeping in touch with him and the rest of the cartel through BlackBerry Messenger, or BBM, BlackBerry's proprietary chatting service. Zazueta Godoy, better known as Capi Beto, was a big fish in Sinaloa's corporate structure, a top logistics expert for Guzman and Mayo Zambada, responsible for moving huge loads of cocaine from Central America through Mexico and then across the border. Donovan already had his own strange link to Capi Beto. Years before, the transport specialist had helped to plan the 20-ton shipment from Panama that Donovan had busted early in his career. The LA office of the DEA immediately opened a case on Capi Beto, hoping to follow his trail of BBM chats back to his bosses in Mexico. But when the agents started looking for the legal means to tap into his BlackBerry, they ran into a curious dead end. Anyone, it seemed, could send a BlackBerry chat to anyone else from anywhere in the world. But no matter where the chats originated, BlackBerry routed them through its own internal relay servers in Canada. Because the servers were not in the United States, they were technically beyond the reach of American surveillance. In June 2012, however, just as the LA case seemed doomed to fail, the agents got an unexpected gift. BlackBerry's parent company, Research in Motion, suddenly relocated its servers from Canada to Texas. That single, fortuitous decision put Capi Beto and his BBM chats back within the crosshairs of the California office. A wiretap was approved on Capi Beto, and in almost no time it was spewing like a fire hose. Within a matter of weeks, the agents in LA were drowning in information. Their line sheets were endless, and each passing day contained new chats about pickup times, drop-off times, load sizes, warehouse locations, the names of couriers, the phone numbers for drivers, even Facebook links to news reports of seizures. The LA office could barely keep up. Capi Beto, a major player, was hooked into deals all over the world, and as he thumbed his BBMs to operatives from Ecuador to Ohio, each new BlackBerry he contacted was also subject to the tap. Soon, the web of targets expanded exponentially, and the agents in LA were forced to farm out leads to colleagues in 21 domestic offices and 19 foreign offices, all of them eavesdropping on Sinaloa Blackberries. It was as if the cartel's collective brain had suddenly grown a voice. "It was a feeding frenzy," said Wayne Brosetano, one of Donovan's partners at SOD. "It seemed too good to be true." To Donovan, Crackberry was a game changer. The direct results of the operation were notable on their own, a steady drumbeat of busts and arrests around the world. But more important, Crackberry transformed the way that the DEA conducted surveillance, especially in Mexico. Before the operation, federal agents depended on the Mexican authorities to tap communications devices being used inside their country. If their cooperation was not forthcoming, which it often was not, or was hindered by corruption, which it often was, the DEA was forced to build its cases the old-fashioned way, a laborious process of making seizures, arresting suspects, and trying to turn them into informants. Now, however, if Blackberries were being used, and increasingly they were, as Capi Beto had shown, the agency could run its own wiretaps on foreign subjects straight from American soil. "Prior to Crackberry, we were in the dark," Donovan said. "But once we had the new technique, it opened everything up. It was like an explosion. Stuff started coming in from everywhere." The technology that Crackberry unleashed became a kind of investigative accelerant. When the ability to wiretap BBM chats was applied to cases that were already smoldering, they erupted into flames. For arcane legal reasons, the agents in L.A. had initially used state law to authorize their wire. By the end of the year, however, their investigation into Capi Beto and his crew had become so complicated they needed a federal partner. After an aborted courtship in their own backyard, they chose to work with the United States Attorney's Office in Chicago. It was a logical decision. By late 2012, the Chicago office, or in federal parlance, the Northern District of Illinois, was 3 years into one of the most robust Sinaloa prosecutions in the country. The case had at first been based on cartel turncoats. Pedro and Margarito Flores, the Chicago-born twins who handled much of Guzman's American distribution, had by that time reached a plea agreement in northern Illinois and provided prosecutors in the office with a trove of secretly recorded audio tapes of Guzman and his minions committing various drug deals. Handsome, charismatic, and born speaking English, the twins were poised to be devastating witnesses if the crime lord was ever put on trial. The story they could tell was both damning and meticulously detailed. In the broadest sense, the brothers could describe selling as many as 40 tons of Guzman's cocaine over the years, earning him a staggering fortune of nearly $1 billion. On the micro level, they could talk about his neurotic demand that they send their profits back to him in $100 bills, not the tens and twenties they collected from the streets. Larger denominations, they were told, were easier to count. Chicago had another, perhaps even better, star witness queued up: Vicente Zambada, the son of Mayo Zambada, Guzman's longtime partner. Not yet 40, Vicente had been groomed since childhood to serve as the cartel's heir apparent, a child of royalty anointed to run the Sinaloa kingdom when Guzman and Mayo retired. In 2009, however, this succession plan had been interrupted when Vicente was arrested by troops in Mexico City and was shipped to Chicago to stand trial. There he dropped a bombshell while fighting his prosecution. The cartel princeling claimed that just before he was taken into custody, he had met with a group of American officials and reached a secret deal with them to trade information on Sinaloa's rivals in exchange for permission to run his business freely. While it was certainly the case that Vicente had spoken with the DEA and Chicago federal prosecutors under cloak and dagger circumstances in a Mexican hotel room, the American authorities denied a quid pro quo. When a judge agreed, Vicente was stripped of his best defense and decided to cooperate with the office in Chicago, right about the time it inherited the Crackberry wire from Los Angeles. The combination of Vicente's human intelligence and Crackberry's eavesdropping technology produced one of Donovan's explosions, Chicago was soon tapped into the deepest levels of Guzman's organization, grabbing BlackBerry chats not only from Capibeto, but also from one of the kingpin's sons, from his chief of staff, and from a top cartel assassin. Something similar was taking place in San Diego. In June 2012, the same month CrackBerry was launched, the police in Chula Vista, California, stopped a man named Hector Laranga for pausing at a red light with his front tires illegally touching a crosswalk. In the trunk of his car were four bricks of cocaine, neatly packed in gift wrap. The Laranga case appeared at first to be a modest step in a modest probe of a modest distribution ring based in the suburbs of San Diego County. But in mid-December, after some of the suspects were found to be using BlackBerry Messenger, the DEA's San Diego office went up on a wiretap in an operation codenamed Narco Polo. The Narco Polo wire and the Chicago wire were soon joined at the hip, and as the taps progressed, they focused on a new and growing list of targets. In San Diego, those included another one of Guzman's sons, three more of Mayo's sons, Guzman's top man in Culiacan, his stronghold city near the mountains, and a few key leaders of the two men's favorite hit team, a band of killers who called themselves Los Anthrax. As the winter went on, so did the roaring CrackBerry wildfire. In early 2013, it spread to Arizona, where a group of agents from a little-known law enforcement outfit, Homeland Security Investigations, HSI, working from a small regional office near the border in Nogales, went up on what was now a third BlackBerry wire. The Homeland Security case, Operation Paisano, had started 2 years earlier as a domestic undercover probe targeting a money laundering ring that was making cash drops everywhere from shopping malls in Atlanta to public sidewalks in New York. When the agents discovered that some of the money launderers were using BBM, the investigation pivoted midstream. Using the new tool that CrackBerry provided, they followed a heavy flow of BlackBerry chats from the money movers to a cell of transportation experts who were putting together large loads of cocaine in Colombia, Ecuador, and Guatemala. The Arizona border mucks, as they self-effacingly called themselves, were not traditional drug cops like their DEA colleagues in Chicago and San Diego. And while they had not initially set out to join the chase for Guzman, they were quickly at the heart of it. Their lead agent, Jake Healy, a novice investigator, was, in the way of rookies, already obsessed with one of his first targets, a cartel operative nicknamed Speedy, who was sending hundreds of kilos of cocaine from his base in Guatemala back to his masters in Mexico. As Speedy went about his business, he never stopped texting, knocking out as many as 1,000 BBMs a day. Sitting in Nogales, Healy was mystified by Speedy's constant chatter. Moreover, no one seemed to have a clue about who he was. There was nothing on him in any of the usual federal databases. In his office and at home over beers, Healy read and reread Speedy's line sheets, wondering who this industrious motormouth could be. The problem was that the wiretap on Speedy, like those in all the other cities, was busy, dense, and maddeningly baffling. The coded messages coming in around the clock were practically inscrutable. 11:14 p.m. Good evening, buddy. We need to send memo to Unit 10, and my friend from Mexico just checked in. He says the rats are bewildered, and they have not heard from the godson at all. On the other hand, buddy, how is Pollito doing? 11:29 p.m. Okay, that was good news about your friend. God willing, we can continue like that. Very good on the memo matter. Pollito agreed to check in tomorrow, saying he had a meeting with the friend that manufactures the furniture that is imported. He said all was going good. The people sending these texts were as mysterious as the messages themselves, and dozens of them were now showing up on wiretap lines across the country. Each appeared to be using a secret screen name, Cobra, Jorgon, Hugo Boss. The monikers were much like the ones that Marston and Patash had found in Guzman's FlexiSpy chats. Ornately cryptic, they might or might not have been hints at the sender's real identities. Racking their separate brains in their separate airless wire rooms, the agents in Nogales, San Diego, and Chicago have been swiping at this fog for weeks. Juiced on adrenaline and coffee, they were gasping for clues that could help them understand the endless flurry of enigmatic texts. Who was Enrique? Where was L-19? And what in God's name were the blue ones? This was the bewildering landscape that surrounded Ray Donovan within 6 months of arriving at SOD. If it wasn't already confusing enough, he had in the meantime inherited his own small piece of the puzzle, yet another wire investigation, Operation Landing Strip, that Special Operations was running with his former colleagues in the DEA's office in New York. Landing Strip, like the case in Arizona, had initially focused on a group of transportation brokers who were buying planes for Guzman's organization and shopping for him like purchasing agents for sources of cocaine in Central America. But following the now familiar pattern, it turned into a wiretap case that winter when one of the brokers arrested in Cali offered up a gem, the BlackBerry Pins, for 10 of his close associates. As the New York office started its surveillance, Donovan was excited to discover that these new BlackBerry Pins were all using the same kinds of screen names found on the other BBM wires. Perseo, Biller, Lumbre, Diablo. Donovan became particularly interested in Diablo. There were indications that he was extremely close to Guzman, perhaps was even a member of his family. The early months of 2013 were unprecedented. Around the country, American federal agents were running no less than 4 separate wiretaps tracking different aspects of the Kingpin's massive BlackBerry network. As the year began, Donovan started reaching out to his colleagues in Chicago, San Diego, and Nogales, hoping to connect their efforts to his own in Chantilly and New York. From his first week at SOD, he had dreamed of going after Guzman as a team. Now he could envision what amounted to a grand coalition. There was, however, one last piece to put in place. In the DEA's embassy office in Mexico, an aggressive young agent named Andrew Hogan was also tooling around with Sinaloa BlackBerry Pins. Hogan had been in Mexico for less than a year, but had experience pursuing Guzman's network. In his previous tour of duty in San Diego, he and his former partner had helped take down one of the Kingpin's most prolific money laundering operations. When Hogan left for Mexico City, the partner, Juan Sandoval, stayed in California. Continuing their work, Sandoval was later able to squeeze Guzman's personal BlackBerry pin from a girlfriend at the border, triggering the raids in Cabo San Lucas. Hogan, like Donovan, was a number junkie. In his office at the embassy, he had built a database of every pin connected to Guzman he could find. Some of the pins had come to him from the scraps of his investigations with Sandoval. Some had been found by the Mexican police in a coded address book and the call logs of other BlackBerries that Guzman left behind when he hurried out of his mansion in Los Cabos. Still others, pulled off suspects during drug busts in Colombia and Ecuador, had been sent to Hogan by fellow agents who knew about his obsession with the pins. When Donovan, rounding out his team-building mission, got in touch with Hogan, he immediately recognized a synergy. Hogan had a trove of BlackBerry pins, but was only just beginning to understand the full scope of the wider operation. Donovan was starting to connect the disparate threads of that endeavor and could certainly use more pins to run through the multi-city wiretap machine. Slowly, sometimes grudgingly, the coalition he was hoping to create was coming together. Hogan started talking with his colleagues in Nogales and New York. San Diego had already been talking with Chicago. All of them, of course, were talking with Donovan. This was the way that government was supposed to work, but almost never did. Meanwhile, the intercepts kept coming. 10:23 a.m. "Good morning, sir. Your buddy sends his regards. He said that the technicians will wait 2 days to see how the trip went because they will be leaving today with Profe and the technicians so they can teach Canuto how to make 500 and 500. I will talk to the flower guy next week." By early spring, Donovan's coalition was in place. The surveillance teams were holding late-night conference calls, and morning emails traveled back and forth among 5 cities. As the agents debated and discussed their prey, it sparked a kind of chemical reaction, a collective brain pursuing a collective brain, started to see connections. In Mexico, two of Hogan's central targets were Cachimba, the pilot who had flown Guzman to safety after Cabo, and another one of the kingpin's longtime operatives, Isaías Valdés, a pilot and security expert nicknamed Memín. Both of them began showing up on the Homeland Security wire in Nogales. Two of Nogales's chief targets, the chatterbox Speedy and his partner Omega, turned out to be working in Guatemala with Diablo, Donovan's main target. Oftentimes, a target of the wire in Chicago showed up in San Diego. Just as frequently, a San Diego target showed up in Chicago. At one point, the New York wire crossed targets with San Diego and Chicago. That target later popped up in the work of both Hogan and Nogales. Everything was separate, but related, and all of it was coming into us at SOD, Donovan said. We were all sharing intelligence and starting to paint this picture of what the entire cartel looked like, working independently but together. Think about it like a map of the hierarchy, and now it's starting to come into focus. There was, in fact, a map, just like from Donovan's old days on the task force. It was a constantly changing jigsaw puzzle that showed the Western Hemisphere and was slowly taking shape on a conference table at SOD. Along its outer edges were name-labeled photos of the operatives who worked at the origins and endpoints of Guzman's empire, his supplier in Colombia, Peru, and Venezuela, and his distribution managers in the United States, Canada, and Europe. Moving toward the center from the north were the smuggling teams that worked along the U.S. border. Moving toward the center from the south were the transit teams in Panama, Honduras, Belize, and Guatemala that springboarded his product up from his source countries to Mexico. Closer still to the core were the internal transportation units that ferried drugs through Mexico. Then in the middle, the bullseye, Guzman himself and his inner circle of aides in Sinaloa. Building the map was grueling work that required months of trial, error, and collaborative effort. No one person or agency could determine the identities of this Dickensian cast of characters, let alone define the roles they played in the organization. Chicago could turn to its cooperating witnesses, Vicente Zambada and the Flores brothers, for advice. New York was getting tips from another cartel turncoat, Vicente's uncle and Mayo's brother, Rey Zambada. There were more secret sources feeding information about Guzman and his businesses to agents in Miami, Mexico City, Mazatlan, and Guayaquil. The wiretap machine was driving the intelligence, however, and in May 2013, it started to unravel the deep structure of Guzman's BlackBerry system. Hogan had just gotten his hands on a new pin. It had been found during a series of cocaine busts on Sinaloa speedboats in Ecuador. That same pin had recently appeared on the Narco Polo wire in San Diego when Hogan learned that Jake Healy and his colleagues in Nogales, John Zappone, and Nick Nordstrom were also tracking the pin. He figured that it must be something important. Hogan asked Healy what he and his guys in Arizona knew about the number. Searching through their wiretap line sheets, the team in Nogales determined that the popular pin was linked to a BlackBerry account with an unusual screen name, Office 5. The name sounded different than the usual run of personal monikers like Mimi, Chemita, and Jaguar, and might have been a shortened version of Oficina, the Spanish word for office. Office 5 also appeared to be sending huge orders for drugs and issuing commands to several other BlackBerries on the network. Most tellingly, when those BlackBerries got their orders and commands, they often acknowledged them by asking Office 5 to send their regards to El Gerente, the manager, or to El Señor, the boss. As word of Office 5 spread through the coalition, it was quickly seen as a significant development. The deferential titles, El Gerente and El Señor, were almost certainly meant for Guzman himself and suggested that Office 5 was in direct communication with the boss. If whoever was using the Office 5 device was also in close proximity to Guzman, the account might lead to an even bigger prize, the kingpin's physical location. And yet it wasn't easy to nail down a target's whereabouts with a BlackBerry pin. The DEA had learned that lesson in Cabo. While the technology had improved somewhat, In the year since Victor Vasquez had lost, then found, his little red man, it still wasn't perfect. What you needed most to track a BlackBerry PIN was the device's corresponding phone number. Only phone numbers, not PINs, were registered with cellular providers, and only cellular providers, or people who could access their networks, could ping a number to get locational coordinates. Hogan didn't have a phone number for Office 5. Neither did the wire rooms in San Diego or Nogales. Donovan, however, could get the number. In the aftermath of Operation Crackberry, a member of his team at SOD had cultivated sources inside Research in Motion, BlackBerry's parent company. When these corporate spies were presented with a PIN, they would quietly slip Donovan's man the corresponding phone number. When Donovan got the number for Office 5, he sent it on to Hogan in Mexico. Hogan then passed the number to his own secret sources, who pinged it through the Mexican telecom system. At the end of this long chain, Hogan got coordinates for Office 5. Like the rest of the coalition, he was surprised to find that Office 5 was based in Durango. A large state capital east of Sinaloa, Durango struck everyone as an unlikely place for Guzman himself to be based. It didn't seem to fit the kingpin's profile. When Guzman wasn't in the mountains or at getaways like Cabo, he tended to avoid large cities. The one exception was his stronghold, Culiacan. But in Culiacan, he was protected by his safe houses, a Praetorian guard of gunmen, and much of the local police. But just because Office 5 was in Durango, it didn't mean the kingpin had to be there. There was mounting evidence that Office 5 was a kind of filter device, or what the coalition was now calling a mirror, that was handling Guzman's messages at a distance. All of them were thinking of the raids the year before, when the Mexican police had stormed into houses in Tepic and arrested several of Guzman's men banging away on BlackBerries. Could something similar be happening again? Yes, they decided. It had to be. Durango had become the new Tepic. Once Office 5 was re-envisioned as a cutout in one of Guzman's call centers, the account became the coalition's Rosetta Stone. Taking the lead, Healy and his partners in Nogales started ripping Office 5 apart. Following a trail of BlackBerry chats, they moved from Office 5 to each of the 10 or so lower-level accounts that it was sending orders to. The team in Arizona quickly realized that many of these junior accounts were getting orders from more than one Office account. Instructions might be sent to them by Office 1 or Office 3 as well. Every time a new Office filter was discovered, Hogan got the corresponding phone number from Donovan. When he had his telecom informants ping the locations, all of the Office devices tracked back to Durango. As they slowly mapped the network, the coalition was starting to see the outlines of a pyramid. At the bottom of the pyramid, Guzman's ground-level operatives, men like Speedy, Diablo, and Memin, were checking in from cities around the world with the Office devices in Durango. Their message traffic was as heavy as ever. There were constant reports on drug lords moving from the jungles of Colombia or up the coast of California toward Seattle and Vancouver. The traffic in the opposite direction was equally busy. The Office filters were directing workers in the field to use certain airstrips or to hurry up and send their profits back to El Gerente. Every few days, however, the messages flowing through some of the accounts would drift into silence, and sections of the pyramid would suddenly go dark. This, it was surmised, was a security precaution. The kingpin's men were changing their BlackBerry PINs or tossing their devices. During these blackouts, the coalition scrambled. Scouring the wiretaps, they looked for clues and connections in the intercepts that could help them identify and track the new devices. Sitting in Virginia, Donovan became consumed by the question of where Guzman stood in this pyramid of mirrors. It was clear that the Office accounts were sending orders from the call centers to workers in the field, but who was sending orders to the call centers? The coalition needed a different method of analysis. Through their wiretap approvals, each of the wire rooms not only had access to the heavy flow of BBM chats coursing through the system, they also had access to the metadata or the toll records for the BlackBerries they were tracking. Toll records are call logs. They document every device that any one particular device has been in contact with and how often the contact has occurred. By crunching the toll records, Donovan assumed, the wiretap machine should be able to determine which devices on the network the Ulfius accounts were getting most of their messages from. Ordinary people, using ordinary phones, get most of their messages from a parent, a spouse, a best friend. Drug traffickers using pyramidal BlackBerries get most of their messages from the boss. By mid-July, the toll record data had been analyzed. The Ulfius accounts were getting most of their messages from two new devices with even more unusual screen names, which seemed to have been borrowed from two of Mexico's largest telecom providers, Telcel and Usacell. As soon as these devices were identified, Donovan sent their phone numbers to Hogan down in Mexico. Everyone was hoping that this second tier of the pyramid, as they were now calling it, would be Guzman's tier. But when Hogan got the coordinates for Telcel and Usacell, they too came back as being in Durango. It didn't seem possible, but the new accounts appeared to be more cutouts in yet another call center. There wasn't just a single layer separating Guzman from his workers in the field, there were two. As deflating as the discovery was, second tier ultimately turned into a gold mine. The Nogales wire readers went to work at once, digging into Telcel and Usacell even more ferociously than they dug into Ulfius 5. In short order, they unearthed several new Ulfius accounts feeding into second tier and scores of new field accounts feeding into the new Ulfius accounts. Second tier, they determined, was a clearinghouse of sorts for everything beneath it, and pulling at its threads was like pulling at a weed in your garden and coming up with a huge root system with tentacles going everywhere. Soon Nogales and its sister wires were sucking up BlackBerry chats from every nook and cranny of Guzman's organization. Through second tier, there were lines into his children, his girlfriends, his bodyguards, his plaza bosses, even his cooks and maids. At that point, we realized what we had, Donovan said. We'd broken Chapo's communications network. We had Speedy and Omega in Guatemala. There was great intel from the HSI wire from Central America to Canada. It was crossing with San Diego and crossing with New York. We were in a really good place. Their mindset, he said, wasn't just, let's keep going. Now it was, holy crap, we can actually capture these guys. 7. Duck Dynasty. August 2013 through January 2014. By high summer, things had reached the point where the coalition needed to meet, everyone in the same room at the same time, face to face. Donovan and Hogan picked a date and place, August 21st, at the embassy in Mexico. Invitations were sent out to New York, Chicago, Nogales, San Diego, and several other DEA offices that had been pitching in from the peripheries, Phoenix, Miami, Long Island, Ecuador, Costa Rica, and Vancouver. More than 100 people were asked to attend, among them a few friendly members of the intelligence community. For the first time, Mexican counterparts like SEMAR, the Marines, and the Attorney General's office were brought into the fold. In the run-up to the gathering, Hogan sent Donovan an email proposing that each of the key participants do a PowerPoint presentation focused on how they plan to leverage what they had into takedowns of Guzman, Mayo Zambada, and other high-value Sinaloa targets. After the briefings, they would all split up to discuss their plans in smaller, separate breakout groups. Everyone agreed that the meeting should be geared toward real-world operations on the ground. In his note to Donovan, Hogan mentioned that next month, in September, some of their top subjects would probably be flying to Las Vegas for the big prize fight between Floyd Mayweather and the Mexican boxer Canelo Alvarez. Hogan suggested stopping those who went to Vegas at the airport and giving them a gentle, exploratory squeeze for information. Conspicuously missing when everyone sat down for the event in the embassy's crowded auditorium were Steve Marston and Bob Patash, the last two American agents to have gotten close to Guzman. In advance of the meeting, Donovan had reached out to Marston in New York, extending an invitation, but he had received a curious response. He was very friendly, Donovan recalled. He said, give me a couple of days and I'll get back to you. When Marston called back, he politely declined to join the coalition. He and Patashi explained were doing their own thing. That thing was Andrea Velez. Exactly a year ago, after Christian Rodriguez had fled to the United States, the FBI's Operation Server Jack had found itself on life support. By late in the summer of 2012, Marston and Patash had missed their shots at Guzman in both Cabo and Tepic, and had lost their access not only to the kingpin's encrypted cell phones, but also to his flexi-spy chats. Having lost their young informant, too, the agents were facing a dispiriting situation. If they didn't find a new way of spying on their target, they might have to shut their mission down. Both men were intrigued when their Spanish translator mentioned Andrea. Throughout 2012, Andrea had been showing up in Server Jack's one remaining endeavor, the iPhone intercepts that Marston and Patash were still collecting from Alex Cifuentes. Recently, the translator had noticed that Andrea's texts to Alex and her friends betrayed a certain level of anxiety. In her vulnerable state, the translator suggested she might be a candidate for recruitment. That September, Marston and Patash approached Andrea at the Bogota airport, much like they had Rodriguez. Their timing turned out to be perfect. Andrea was by then in the advanced stages of a nervous breakdown, triggered by the multiple murders that Guzman and Alex were committing. Her own role in the plot to kill Rodriguez had pushed her over the edge. Only days before, she had dropped down onto her knees and prayed to the angels to rescue her. When the two FBI agents pulled her aside at El Dorado International, she decided they must have been the angels she was looking for. Footnote: by the time Ray Donovan invited Marston and Patash to join the coalition, Andrea had been working undercover spying on Guzman and Alex for nearly a year. But it took the FBI several months, until about mid-2013, to alert the DEA that one of its informants had infiltrated the kingpin's inner circle. Andrea had collected good information on Guzman and Alex. In nightly phone debriefings with her handlers, she talked about the two men's operations in Canada and Ecuador, and mentioned visiting one of Guzman's safe houses in Culiacan. Andrea also described the kingpin's movie project, inspiring a brief plot to lure Guzman out of hiding by telling him that Hollywood was interested in his script. Though the plot was abandoned when Guzman, for unrelated reasons, tried to kill Andrea, she did at one point travel to Los Angeles to enlist the assistance of talent agents and producers. From Donovan's point of view, the embassy get-together was a huge success, even without the FBI. His one thing, and he said it in the room, was that everyone on the team needed to be fired up, all in. After the gathering in Mexico, they were. Within days of the meeting, the coalition was back at work in their scattered home base offices. In San Diego, the Narco Polo wire room was pushing ever deeper into Mayo Zambada's world and was following a separate trail with their colleagues in Chicago that seemed to be leading toward Guzman's chief of staff, Damaso Lopez, and his son. Drew Hogan, sometimes at his desk until after midnight, was poring over messages from the pyramid's second tier, looking for the right piece of intelligence to turn the surveillance mission into a capture operation. Building out their own team in Nogales, Healy and his partners hired new translators and line sheet readers. They needed the extra help. As summer drew to an end, the Arizona wire room was exploding. Hundreds of thousands of intercepts had already been collected, and thousands more were streaming in each day from scores of BlackBerries all across the network. With the increased capacity, the overworked border mucks cast a wider net, moving past their initial targets, Speedy and Omega, to an ever-expanding circle that now included Guzman's son, Ivan Archibaldo, his father-in-law, Ines Coronel, and Cholo Ivan, one of his top killers. New figures also kept appearing. One of the latest was an errand boy of sorts, who was often sent by the office to take Guzman's cars to the shop, fetch his meals, and arrange his visits with prostitutes. His screen name was particularly memorable, El Nariz, the nose. In mid-September, Nogales homed in on another new figure, screen name Panchito. Panchito, by all of the evidence in front of them, was a major player in Guzman's operation. According to The Intercepts, he was overseeing much of the kingpin's business in Canada and had become involved in Ecuador with a ground-level worker named Rincon, who was buying bulk shipments of cocaine from guerrillas in Colombia and moving them in airtight glass containers up to Mexico. When Donovan got the readouts on Panchito, he immediately suspected it was Alex Cifuentes. Exciting news, given Alex's close relationship with Guzman. But there was less exciting news when Nogales, following procedure, ran Panchito's BlackBerry PIN through the federal government's deconfliction database. The search showed hits for the last American agents who had spied on Alex and who might be spying on him now, the coalition's old friends, Marston and Patash in New York. It was not the first time that the DEA and the New York FBI had crossed paths in the field while pursuing the same targets. This time, however, with the safety of the wiretap machine on the line, Donovan wanted to avoid a damaging collision. When the FBI called a meeting to discuss Cifuentes a few days later at CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia, Donovan showed up and came to an arrangement with the Bureau and the agency. Everyone agreed that Alex Cifuentes should be arrested now that Nogales had tracked down his location, but there were differences of opinion as to who should make the arrest and how and when it should occur. The DEA traditionally worked with the Mexican police, the FBI, and the CIA with the Army. Before the meeting ended, both sides reached a bottom line. Whoever took Alex into custody, it should be done in a way that did not disrupt anyone's ongoing investigations. The deal did not exactly go as planned. 6 weeks later, the Mexican military launched a shotgun raid on the ranch outside of Culiacan, where Alex was holed up with a crew of bodyguards from Guzman's hit team, Los Antrax. The coalition had not been warned about the mission in advance and only learned about the furious gunfight that it triggered after the fact. Soon enough, the wiretap machine was picking up emergency alerts from second tier, reporting on the battle and ordering the office accounts to dump their devices simultaneously. In virtually no time, big chunks of the pyramid went dark. The arrest of Alex Cifuentes in mid-November 2013 did more than just remove him from the table as a possible conduit to Guzman. The temporary blackout it caused to the kingpin's communication system also threw a wrench into the coalition's most important project at the time, pushing past second tier to whatever was above it. Hogan and Healy had been scratching at the problem since the meeting at the embassy and had, in the meantime, made a few discoveries. They had determined fairly quickly that second tier's accounts, Telcel and USACEL, were not being used by two different people, but were almost certainly replica devices that the same person was using. They had also figured out, through toll record analysis, that second tier wasn't just talking with the office accounts below it. It was also talking with a new account, one that seemed to be using helicopter models like MD-8 and Bell 47 as its screen names. Intriguingly, whenever second tier chatted with this helicopter guy, he showed up in The Intercepts as Condor. The breakthrough came when Nogales started digging into Condor toward the end of the fall. Condor's toll records were fascinating. They were different from those of any other device on Guzman's BlackBerry network. The office phones, for instance, communicated with both ground-level phones and second-tier phones. Second-tier, meanwhile, communicated with the office phones and with Condor's phone. But Condor, it seemed, communicated solely with second-tier. His messages, that is, went in only one direction, down, not up. The pyramid of mirrors appeared to stop with him. The coalition started calling Condor top tier. They theorized that Condor was Guzman's body man, the one standing next to him, receiving his instructions and passing them down along the OFI system's complicated chain. Eager to locate Condor, Hogan rushed his BlackBerry PIN to Donovan, and Donovan got the phone number that same day. When they pinged the number, Condor's coordinates did not track back to Durango like the office devices or the second-tier accounts. Condor's coordinates tracked back to Colonia Libertad, a ramshackle neighborhood in the heart of Culiacán, Guzmán's longtime lair. By late November, with top tier now in sight, things began to suddenly speed up. While Condor had become the central target, the coalition didn't lack for others. Since the discovery of second tier that summer, Nogales and the other wires had been capturing BlackBerry chats from dozens, if not hundreds, of cartel operatives from Montreal to Guatemala City. Sometimes the intercepts were too good to ignore, and the coalition would arrange for local authorities to swoop in on a subject and arrest him. Other times, it was better to be cautious and simply continue listening. It was always hard to make these decisions, which balanced action against gathering intelligence, especially since the coalition had no formal quarterback or shot caller. Ray Donovan could rightly describe himself as a coordinator, but he was in no position to unilaterally issue takedown orders in foreign countries on targets who might be under indictment in different judicial districts. To avoid more disasters like the one in Cabo or the one involving Alex Cifuentes, the coalition developed a rule of thumb. If a high-value target stumbled into a situation where he might be grabbed easily, then and only then would they actually go grab him. An early opportunity came on November 20, 2013, when one of Mayo Zambada's sons, Serafin, crossed the border not far from Jake Healy's office in Nogales to go Christmas shopping with his wife. As soon as Serafin set foot on American soil, he was detained on secret charges already on file in San Diego with evidence collected by the Narco Polo wire. A few weeks later, acting on a tip from the wire in New York, the Mexican police raided a beach resort in Puerto Peñasco on the Gulf of California and killed one of Mayo's top assassins in a gunfight while he was on vacation. The assassin, Macho Prieto, had made the mistake of distancing himself from his power base in Culiacán, and the coalition, watching, had decided he was vulnerable. Then, on December 30th, José Rodrigo Arechiga, or Chino Antrax, the leader of the Los Antrax hit team, left Mexico City for his own vacation in the extradition-friendly nation of Holland. The wiretap machine knew that he was going, and the Dutch police arrested him at Schiphol Airport in Amsterdam. That same month, the coalition discovered another, much bigger opportunity. Throughout the Christmas season, the wire room in Nogales had been picking up whispers that Guzman was acquiring an unusual new collection of recreational equipment. There were suggestions on the wire that his men had bought him mud boots, hunting rifles, even a speedboat with a special airfoiled motor designed to drive on marshes. There were also indications that his four adult sons were regularly traveling from Culiacán to meet him at a mysterious vacation spot that they were calling Pichis. While it wasn't quite clear where Pichis was, it seemed that Guzman was setting up a kind of winter playground there. He had brought in a contractor to build him a swimming pool at Pichis and surrounded it with a few large palapas for afternoon barbecues. Working with Donovan at SOD, Hogan and the team in Arizona began to track the Kingpin's sons, pinging their locations over several days. From the GPS coordinates, they were able to determine that Pichis was somewhere in the sunny wetlands near the Ensenada de Pabellones, a small coastal waterway that fed into the Sea of Cortez, just south of Culiacán. Jake Healy, in his spare time, started doing research on the area. He discovered that the wetlands ecosystem was a migratory flyway, especially for ducks. One night, logging on to Google Earth, Healy took off from his desk in Nogales and sailed above the swamp in Sinaloa, cruising back and forth across the landscape until he found what he was looking for, a few dark smudges that seemed to be palapas. Moving in closer, he saw with a shock that the palapas were down the road from a well-known local tourist trap, the Pichiguila Duck Hunting Club. No one could believe it, but it was right there on the map. The club at Pichis was a posh affair, an eco-chic resort with a dining gazebo and air-conditioned bungalows where hunters cool down after mornings on the lagoon, shooting at the rafts of pintails and gadwalls flying overhead. Guzman's palapas were a few miles south of the club in a more remote stretch of the marshes. There was no one around for miles, and the flat terrain, free of obstacles or hiding spots, was nearly ideal for an aerial assault. The coalition could not have invented a better place to stage a raid. They all started calling it Duck Dynasty. "It was perfect for us," Donovan said. "It was out of the way and far from his usual stronghold, and he was going there pretty regularly." Chasing Condor would have to wait. Duck Dynasty had now become the target. The next time Guzman went there, the coalition would be going too, to grab him. But first they had to find a partner, which was always the catch in Mexico. For many years, the DEA had worked with a special team of federal police called the Sensitive Investigative Unit, or the SIU, whose officers were trained and vetted by the agency itself. After the bungled raids in Cabo and Tepic, which were led on the ground, and perhaps also compromised by the SIU, many of Donovan's law enforcement colleagues began having doubts about the unit and about the loyalties of the larger federal police force. Some of those doubts had been raised with Donovan when he sat down in Langley with the FBI and the CIA just before the Army raid on Alex Cifuentes. The FBI was especially concerned about the federal police. In mid-2013, it had quietly assigned one of its top drug agents to investigate corruption in the force. By the end of that year, the agent's work confirmed to him what many in the U.S. government already suspected, that the SIU and the federal police could, to a significant extent, be described as the uniformed enforcement wing of Guzman's organization. As the raid on Duck Dynasty drew near, many of these critics undertook a pressure campaign to persuade the DEA to stay away from the federal police this time. The stakes were too high, and the cops in Mexico were far too unreliable. The FBI and the CIA were once again pushing to use the Army, but the DEA didn't trust the Army any more than the Bureau and the agency trusted the police. Others, among them the U.S. Marshals, were advocating for the Mexican Marines. The Marines, they said, had the total package. They were driven, skilled, and absolutely fearless. Trained by the U.S. military, the Marines had been used for years as an elite warfighting unit and had only recently been called upon to serve on the home front battlefield of fighting the country's drug cartels. Their first major anti-cartel mission was the bloody raid against Guzman's enemy, Arturo Beltrán Leyva, in December 2009. It was typical of the Marines' esprit de corps that after they had killed Arturo, they covered his naked body in cash and put pictures of it on the internet. There were great personal dangers in treating traffickers like that. Not long after the photographs appeared, some of Arturo's gunmen crashed the funeral of a Marine who had died in the raid and slaughtered several members of his family. There were also grave political risks. Guzman had long been protected by the highest levels of the Mexican government. Staging an assault on him could easily put the Marines into conflict with their own civilian leaders. And yet when the coalition offered them the job, they took it. "We asked them to go after Sinaloa, and they did," Donovan said. "They took the challenge. In the eyes of the DEA, and almost anyone else who had anything to do with this, they were national heroes. There should be monuments to them somewhere." As the Marines began to plan their operation, so did the coalition. Many of the American faces were familiar. Jake Healy flew from Nogales to join Drew Hogan at the embassy and monitor the mission from a Mexican perspective. Donovan and his team at SOD holed up in Chantilly with their jigsaw puzzle map, waiting for the moment when Guzman headed south to Pichiguila. As soon as that happened, they planned to serve as a communications relay station, sending fresh leads, more or less in real time, from the wiretap machine to the operatives embedded with the Marines. Donovan's link to the Mexican troops was another familiar face, Victor Vasquez, who had helped to oversee the raids in Cabo. Vasquez joined the new Marine strike force late in January when it set out from Mexico City and went down to its staging area at a naval base in La Paz across the Sea of Cortez from Duck Dynasty. Vasquez's job was to eat, sleep, and move with the Marines. He trained with the unit, rappelled with them out of Black Hawks, helped them analyze the feeds from the drones above the target zone, and shared the accumulated wisdom of the wiretap machine to build what he was calling a capture book of intelligence. Vasquez, in a sense, was also in charge of operational security. The raid at Pichiguila had been kept under an exceedingly tight lid. But as the FBI's corruption investigator had recently discovered, the federal police were already trying to ferret out the details. Even the Marine commander at the base in La Paz was never told what his colleagues who had come down from the capital were up to. Spirits were running high as the Marines moved into place on January 19th. Hogan, sitting at the embassy, figured it would be a no-brainer. The helicopters would fly across the water, land at Pichiguila, and nab the kingpin in his apron as he was grilling carne asada. The team in Nogales was also optimistic. "We thought, hey, from an operational standpoint, this could actually work," said their supervising agent, Matt Allen. Donovan was particularly pumped. As the operation was about to launch, the wiretap machine had turned Guzman inside out. It knew what he ate for dinner, where he went to parties, and when he sent flowers to his girlfriends. "We had a sense of this man and this organization," Donovan said, "probably more than at any other time in history." Just a few days earlier, the wire in Nogales had overheard the kingpin violating his own operational security. In a rare lapse of protocol, Guzman had picked up a BlackBerry himself and traded several personal texts with his ex-wife Griselda Lopez. Griselda, it appeared, had recently dropped by one of his safe houses in Culiacan and accidentally run into his latest mistress. Nogales caught her giving it to Guzman in a cobra-necking string of BBMs. 2:35 p.m. "I know about your new acquisition. Congratulations. Just remember that we stop loving, but we always know how to appreciate. And you definitely abandoned us. That's why you don't do well in life, because in the end, you are alone." 2:38 p.m. "Changing the subject. Please send me money for the month. You owe me December and January." There was only one note of caution being struck, and it was coming from another old hand who had joined the coalition, Brian Maxwell from the Marshals Service. As a signals expert, Maxwell felt that the operational plan to take Duck Dynasty was flawed. He knew better than most that Guzman and his men were no mere corner boys trading messages on payphones and pagers. As impressive as the coalition's surveillance effort was, Guzman's methods of countering it were even more impressive. The means and equipment he had at his disposal rivaled anything being used by the world's most sophisticated terror organizations. Maxwell's primary concern was that the kingpin's network of spies and his closet full of snooping devices would detect the Marines before they put their boots on the ground, no matter how tightly the lid on the mission had been kept. If, or rather when, the operation was discovered, he imagined, the odds of Guzman leaving Culiacan and going to Duck Dynasty were somewhere between nil and not a chance. Maxwell was right. On January 20th, one day after Vasquez and the strike force of Marines arrived at the Navy base in La Paz, the wiretap machine began to see disturbing messages on Damaso Lopez's account. 10:04 a.m. "Good morning. Greetings to the compadre and to you guys. Let compadre know that the ones from the water are looking for an area to install themselves by the Conchal. Rumor is that for a minimum of 6 months." 6:05 p.m. "Three fast ones from the water arrived at Castillo, all hooded ones. They're special forces from the water, like they want to have an operation at L-19. The commander is going to let us know later on once he talks to them. Let's see what he finds out." 6:21 p.m. "They're reporting 4 PFP trillas in La Calma. We have to be on alert in case they want to cross El Charco." 9:14 p.m. "The guys from the water are investigating where the bridges are. Seems they want to set up around there. The bridges of the Pichiguila by water are very close, sir. And they are like 12 fast ones, 4 trucks and 1 dually truck. Special forces from the water. An operation. We have to be on alert. Pichiguila. The mission at Duck Dynasty was blown before it began.